Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. We're going to talk about this Lebanese election and events in the Middle East, the ramifications of it, we could say, with Zafar Bengash, Crescent-International.something. I'll look it up. And then later we will talk about Phil and I about Fred Jerome's latest book on the re-release of his book on Einstein, The Einstein File, the story of Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI, who probably is remembered by today's youth as somebody equivalent to Custer, I guess. But we'll be talking to one another about that because I think it's a very important book and we want to call it to people's attention. And there's another text as well, of course, is Stephen Gowans, who's coming to Toronto, and he's going to be in Hamilton. And Phil, you have the information on that.
Yes. Yeah, so Stephen Gowans' book is being launched, Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, The Story of Korea's Struggle for Freedom. And it'll be next Monday in Hamilton at the New Vision United Church, 24 Main Street West at 7 p.m. That's Monday the 14th. Tuesday the 15th at McMaster University Student Center, room 220 at 12:30 p.m. Wednesday the 16th here in Toronto with a different book list, 779 Bathurst Street at 7 p.m. And Thursday at 7 p.m., that's May 17th, that's a week this coming Thursday, at 290 Danforth Avenue. So he'll be doing four appearances in 4 days.
He couldn't have picked a better time to talk about Korea. There will be more questions. I bet there'll be as many questions taking up the time as the talk itself because this Korean settlement or the approach to it is surrounded by a lot of problems. And so we can't wait to hear Mr. Gowans.
CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
And we are back. There we go. Just, with a little drum beat. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5. You can find us on Facebook / The Taylor Report. And on SoundCloud, Taylor-Report. I'm really glad that Zafar told us the story of and listen, all credit to Neil MacDonald, CBC. He didn't just let the story run past and take his hat off and say he thought, well, let's go to the source. And then when it turned out to be no source, then he got in touch with the ambassador, and the ambassador said that's true. That they, Hezbollah had not said what the Liberal government said they had, which was a foundation of, okay, throw them out the brute. We had to – overnight, with a big decision, and everybody went along, and Hezbollah was labeled terrorist. Today, we'll remind our listeners, they are apparently the most popular political party in Lebanon. So that should be a little, one more illustration of why everybody should get their facts straight, which brings me to Phil's, who is it, the critic, foreign affairs critic of the NDP?
Yes, Miss Laverdière, who is a retired diplomat.
Former diplomat.
Or a former diplomat, or something like that, who ran for the NDP and was elected in the Jack Layton sweep in 2011 and got reelected. And she has grabbed control of the foreign policy secretariat of the NDP, and she's not letting go. So, of course, any other point of view, she doesn't tolerate. Mm-hmm. And she tweeted this this week. The Americans have cut off funding to the White Helmets. Because even the Americans can smell, right?
Well, I wouldn't come. Let's just go to what she said.
She said, I met with Syria Civil Defense, the White Helmets, recently. The United States is freezing their funding. I asked Chrystia Freeland and Canada Foreign Policy to urge the Trump administration to reverse their decision. This is about saving lives.
Yeah.
That's her tweet.
Yeah. Now, that's – and there's a photograph. She's very proud of it.
Yeah. There's a photograph of her with the people.
You know, by the way, when you do these things, it's generally considered good manners to tell us who you're standing next to. And in this case, she doesn't identify.
No, she does not identify. There's six other people in the photo.
But
we don't know who they are.
We'll do a little thing here. In the first sentence, she says, "I met the Syria Civil Defense recently." Syria Civil Defense. She did not meet Syria Civil Defense. This is a problem, and this is people talk about how insidious. Manipulation of perception and of information is. There is, in fact, a serious civil defense organization. It is a bona fide organization. It is a member of an international community. It has existed for 63 years, if I've got the dates right, about 63 years. And that means that it is affiliated to recognize internationally recognized bodies in other countries, similar bodies, which are to provide emergency work in times of crisis, earthquakes, wars, whatever. It involves such things as demonstration of a knowledge to conduct the work, that there's some standards. So there is actually, I want her to know, and I want the NDP to know, and anybody, all Canadians to know, there is actually a Syrian civil defense organization. This is an imposter. This is actually the parasite trying to take over the real thing. This is a private organization, not the Syrian civil defense. This is a private organization. We'll come to the dirty word white helmets. That's just public relations malarkey. These guys are affiliated to the terrorist elements. They operate only in terrorist-controlled areas. When we say terrorists, we're talking about the jihadists who waged this war against the Syrian government in the name of sectarian causes and against people, against other ethnic identities, religious identities, against Christians, against Alawi, against Shia. And standing in their midst and always with them are these people called the White Helmets who say that they are Syrian civil defense. They are not. And further to that, she doesn't recognize, NDP, is that they're helping camouflage an attempt to replace the bona fide organization. They actually in the early going of the fightings, they were feeling headstrong and thought they were very confident. So they went out of their way to make accusations against the existing civil defense organization so that they could become a replacement. It's really called regime change, and NDP is working on regime change. That is, you go into a place where there's a government institution, you hollow it out by violence, and through propaganda, and then you take over, like the parasite against the host. She is advancing that, and so it's. And when she says it's about saving lives, that's really not true. This is an organization which has said that it is neutral, but in fact, it only condemns the violence coming from the government side, and it has called for the removal of the president of Syria. And, of course, this story of the funding, in the early stage of the story, the myth, the legend of the White Helmets, so-called, is that they were independent. But and they didn't take money from governments. That has now morphed into give us more money, which is a really peculiar place to be. Since about the story originally was, no, they're independent. They're just there to save lives. But now it's come to light that they were financed by the UK, by France, and by the United States. And so here the NDP is saying that they want the United States to continue to give to an organization that used to claim that it didn't get any money from them. And so this is a very advanced work, I would say, coming from the New Democratic Party to aid and abet an organization which is not neutral but actually is engaged in attempting to remove the present government of Syria, which tells us that this is serious misleading of the Canadian public to say, oh, it's about saving lives. You know, they like to say, we've saved 100,000 lives. Well, who's the source for that? They are. And really most important, we almost had a war, that we were told. It certainly seemed dangerous when the France, the UK, and the US, which is, I understand, spells something like fuck us, I think is roughly how that you'd, if they alliterated it, they fired missiles, deadly missiles, into Syria from their warships and various other places. And the NDP pretended to be alarmed about this. And, you know, they said, well, you know, it's a crisis situation and we could be ought to be careful. But they were – they have to say – we asked, why do you help blow the alarm, the false alarm brought by the White Helmets? They're the ones – it was the White Helmets who provided the only evidence that there had been a chemical attack in the place called Douma. Now, I think any rational person would tell you, is evident there was no chemical attack. But it was there. It was the White Helmets who produced the video footage. We've all seen it. I think you have you seen it, Phil, the little boy having his head washed?
Oh, yes, of course.
Well, okay. Now, once again, the foreign policy critic of the NDP is talking about how, you know, these are lifesavers, et cetera, when in fact they tried to provoke a war by lying about an incident and staging a show. And I would like the NDP, I like her in particular, since she's supposed to be one of the advanced people. They're very proud of her. She has diplomatic credentials and all that. A diplomat, by the way, is someone who will lie for his country. But so she should be together with us interrogating the story. The little boy in the film that the world was shown and which caused the U.S., France, and England to attack has been identified. He has been interviewed, and he was not the victim of a chemical attack. But also in the film, it's their film, the film of the White Helmets. In that film are two men also identified who are actually medical professionals who were working there. They were the ones who were looking after the people who had – there had been an attack. There were people who had smoke inhalation and that sort of thing. They were treating it, and they said, so they've come forward. So thank you, White Helmets. We've got your film, and we also have the two men who were in your film, and they say your film is a fake. And as a matter of fact, you're a fake. And something came up from my observation. The only thing I've noticed, that I haven't heard anybody explain this to me. White Helmets, according to this NDP critic, are lifesavers. Actually, the people working in that clinic were not White Helmets. So in other words, well, what are they exactly? The ones who were saving lives, the ones who were actually administering, were medical people. They weren't White Helmets. So why doesn't – if she cares so much and NDP cares so much, why don't they give aid and to those who actually did save lives? Because the guy with a garden hose pouring water on the kid's head, he didn't save a life. He he was doing a show. And as many people pointed out, not only are these guys selfless, dedicated lifesavers, but they have very advanced camera crews that go with them wherever they go. And they know their timing is always exquisite. And another detail that also I noticed that was raised by the former arms inspector who exposed the U.S. in Iraq. He's now commenting about the situation in Syria. He said an obvious question. Why is it that every time we see a white helmet film of them rescuing, there's never a rough character with a beard and a gun who needs rescuing? The only people who get rescued are little children being carried by men who are, you know, acting like they might want to be in a film with someone from Hollywood. You know, you don't see the kind of people you would expect to see. After a blast, I would expect to see some kind of rough characters, and I like the Red Cross. I believe that if a rough guy, even a bearded one who was a flesh eater, as Zafar described him, he should be cared for, of course. But the only people in that film who could care for him would have been the actual men who came forward and said, yeah, that's me in the film. I don't know who those men were. They came into and they started yelling, chemical attack, and pouring water on people. But he said, we examined them. There was no chemical evidence of a chemical factor. All takes me back to NDP and why they putting their shoulder to the wheel to help in regime change in Syria. Why don't they knock it off? Why don't they, you know, the NDP is supposed to have some principles about, you know, we wanting to bring peace and reconciliation to the world and not favoring arms. This is favoring a group which practices propaganda to initiate wars. That's what the White Helmets do. And they are not the Syrian civil defense. They are an imposter group. So at any rate, that's some of the matters that I have.
Can I mention, Phil, that I did read, and I can't tell you where I read it, but that an American physician who was a cardiologist looked at some of the footage of the white helmets, and this was footage of a white helmet attaching leads from an electrocardiogram machine. And he said, that guy doesn't know what he's doing. He says, in the way he's attaching them, you couldn't get any information from that EKG. It was just play acting. Yeah. It was like an actor pretending to play a piano in Hollywood when he can't play a note, right?
Well, yeah, they arranged it for aesthetic purposes. In other words, they're like a guy who makes a movie in Hollywood. They don't go by what would be medically – but what it would appear – you know, what really looks like the real thing, not the real thing. People who give advice on these things are always frustrated because they discover that, you know, the storyteller knows what he's looking for in an image. And that's why it's public relations. It has nothing to do with – health services. I want to remind the NDP that the founder of the organization, look it up, it's on every site, is a man named Messier. He is a British military man now working privately, and he's a black ops man, and he used to be with Blackwater, and he worked in Kosovo and Iraq. And it just turns out he's the guy who pulled this all together, this little show. This is a serious case of social democrats running errands for the imperialists. That's all. There's really no nice way to put it. And if you think this is, you know, you think they're neutral people, here's a question also to be asked. Why is it when the bad guys finally give up the way they did in Douma and the way they did in Aleppo, where they fight and swear they're going to be martyred and they're going to fight to the end, and then they realize, no, they're not going to. So then they negotiate a sweet deal for themselves because the Syrian government is reasonable and the Russians who are there are reasonable. If they can get the idiots to stop fighting and get rid of the heavy stuff, then okay, they let them go away. So as the Chinese proverb says, for the fleeing enemy, build a golden bridge and let them run. So anyway, they not only do they say, okay, we're ready to quit and go home, but buses are provided. We're now used to the idea that a terrorist group can fight till the last moment and then wave the white flag and say, where's my bus? And then the bus comes and they get on the bus. Okay, NDP wise men, the white helmets are getting on the buses with them. How come? Why is it they go with these guys? Why are they part of the operation? They negotiate the removal of some of the worst terrorists the world has seen, and the white helmets get on the same bus? And like, okay, see you in Idlib. They go off to Idlib. So if the leader, the foreign affairs critic, would like to get to meet her heroes, just go to the terrorist capital of Idlib. They're all there. And she could even join them if she wants. But stop pretending these guys have anything to do with life-saving. This is simply a whistle to call in airstrikes. All they have to do is put up a little video and say, America, come and bomb us. And they'll do it. And of course, because it's coordinated. Now, Phil, go back to the beginning. You mentioned, well, the U.S. is saying no more dough for the white helmets. I don't know that that's clear yet, what they're doing. But one thing is, I would think, is might have motivated them, is that actually some of the worst characters in the terrorist operation are quitting. The political leader of this outfit called Jaish al-Islam, he's departed the scene. So he was one of these ferocious people talking about killing Alawi, killing Christians. He's now, they say, opening a restaurant in Turkey. So I will not patronize the place. I can promise you that. This is CIUT 89.5 FM. We'll have a little music, a violin perhaps, and we'll be back. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon, Wednesday, Classical Underground, 6 to 8 p.m. And we want to remind you, Stephen Gowans is coming on the he's in Hamilton on what date?
On May the 14th at the New Vision United Church at 7 p.m., 24 Main Street West, and at the McMaster University Student Center, room 220 at 12:30 noon on the 15th. And then he's going to come to Toronto, and he'll be at the different book list on May the 16th, which is a week Wednesday.
The 779
Bathurst Street at 7 p.m., and at 290 Danforth Avenue at 7 p.m. on Thursday the 17th. So he's got 4 days in a row promoting
his book.
The
subject is important. The title is Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, the story of Korea's struggle for freedom. And because the issue is now joined as to whether or not there's going to be a peace agreement and denuclearization of the peninsula and the region, perhaps one Korea. That would be an amazing phenomenon. It's up to them entirely. I do know that they will not require the services of the United States military any further. They've been there since 1945. Speaking of 1945, the reason we just played the what was that?
That was the Red Army singing Slavyanka, an old Russian marching song, which the Red Army brought up to date and sang as they marched into Berlin.
Yes, they took it to Berlin.
They did take it to Berlin.
It was a road show.
Yes.
They had a visitor, came to their house, and then they went to his house.
Yes.
And they found the bad guy with the mustache. He disposed of himself. We appreciated that.
Can I mention the names of the armies that liberated Berlin?
Please do.
It was the first Belarusian army, which, of course, were made up of people who came from Belarus, and the first Ukrainian army, and that it is who liberated Berlin from the Nazis.
That's right. Christian Freeland's grandfather was not in that group.
No.
He had departed and remained at that time on the payroll of the German authorities. And we are not permitted to ask her about that because it would be bad form. And she's never said anything bad about him. And so and Canadians, of course, have such good manners that they say, you've never said anything critical of Grandpa. And he was on the German payroll. Some people have actually gone to the pains to describe him as a Ukrainian nationalist or patriot. I think traitor would be closer. He went to Germany. His country was attacked and occupied by Germany, and he was working for them in Poland at a good salary. He was living in a house that had been taken from a Jewish gentleman who was had been the proprietor of a newspaper. The Germans took that paper over. They took the house over. They gave the house to Christa Freeland's grandfather, whom she says she loves and honors and respects very, very much, and has never changed, never said anything about him other than he was marvelous. And then, and also allowed everybody to think that he was some kind of nationalist. You don't go to Poland working for the Nazis and get to be called a Ukrainian nationalist, as far as I know. If you do, you belong in some kind of record book for goofiness. This is the Tater Report, CIT 89.5 FM. And I want to, and apropos of this matter, we wanted to, of course, play that music because tomorrow will be the official date for the end of World War, the German signing of a surrender. I got to get that right. It's a little detail about the surrender. It's very important to know because it feeds right into contemporary politics. At the very last moment, the Germans went out of their way to try to play a little game where they said to Eisenhower and the other allies of the Soviet Union, we'll sign a peace agreement with you separately. They didn't, you know, they just said, we'll meet you so-and-so and sign it. And to his credit, and because he wasn't an idiot, Einstein said,
yeah.
We'll come to him. Eisenhower, another German-American, but he said, no, of course not. It'll only be signed for in front of everybody. The Russian general will be there.
And it will be unconditional. It has to be an unconditional surrender.
Yes. Much debated, by the way, after the war. Mm. Many people thought, oh, you should have. And there were people who wanted to exploit differences and create, and they worked very hard. And certainly the Germans up to the last tried to create a division. Well, of course, subsequent to all of that, there has been division. And the book by Fred Jerome, The Einstein File, The FBI's Secret War Against the World's Most Famous Scientist, is being republished with an additional information by Fred Jerome. And I really urge people to get it. It is at a different book list, and it has a foreword by David Suzuki, and the title of his piece is perfect. He says, Squelching Scientists Then and Now, and he would know.
He certainly would. How timely.
The daily news, pick up your newspaper, and Dr. Suzuki is having a hard time. But he's used to that. He was incarcerated during World War II, he and his family. And it was a good training for him in civil liberties, civil rights. He found out how many rights you have. One shot is fired, and you get locked up based on your ethnicity. The foreword is written by Ajamu Baraka, and it's titled Einstein and McCarthyism, Old and New. Ajamu Baraka was the Green Party candidate for vice president and a really outstanding writer and thinker. He's really on this point that we all should be. I mean, Fred Jerome didn't reissue this because he just wants you to know about Einstein in the 1950s. And no, because it is now. It's today. Pathological dislike, the Pavlovian, I guess, Russians appreciate our bringing in Pavlov, but being able to just say Russia and know that you're going to get a visceral reaction, that's, you have to really train people to get that done. And of course, it did happen in the 1950s. And Einstein fought it. He put himself in the path and therefore drew the attention of the FBI. I should mention, too, another author. We should talk about this on the Friday morning show because this is a major American cultural figure. Thomas Pynchon has written the following about this book. This carefully researched and reported account of Einstein's surveillance by the FBI adds new, what Einstein might call dimension, not only to his personal history, but maybe even to our own present-day character as a nation. Fred Jerome has given us back a piece of our history and hopefully of our conscience as well. I would say to Mr. Pynchon, yeah, hope. Cross your fingers. I've read the book, and I urge everybody to get a copy. I'll just say that you get an understanding of how adversarial the so-called the state is towards people who have independent ideas. One of the things that got Einstein in trouble, big trouble, was 3 minutes. Was that he appeared on an NBC television. It was really at the beginning of television. A wonderful woman named Eleanor Roosevelt had a show briefly. And so she had Albert Einstein on to talk about world peace and the importance of nuclear disarmament and to creating a safe and livable world. He was for what they call world government, which in a sense you could say the United Nations is tilting in that direction. But he also said, be careful about secret police, he didn't call them that, the internal security organizations abusing people's rights. And listening to the show, watching it, was J. Edgar Hoover. And he said, who is this guy, Einstein? Yeah. And he began to, he called his assistants the next morning and said, I want you to build a file. I want to get to, he didn't say, I'm going to get him, but it's understood. Bring me everything you've got. And that would mean, tell me about the women, tell me about the drugs, tell me about bad bank accounts, debts. He wanted to get him. But he had to keep it quiet because, of course, to be caught in the open attacking Einstein, not a good thing. So he just wanted to have his little cannon in place so that when the man walked by, he could pull the trigger. Eleanor Roosevelt, by the way, I think in a way she was more, at that moment, more dangerous, of course, than Einstein, because she was the widow of the most beloved leader of the war. War leaders are always loved. I don't know if people understand that, but they are. And so when she put Einstein on, she was really striking a blow. She was scheduled to have Paul Robeson the next week. And NBC told her no. And their note to her and to the programmer was there'd be no useful purpose would be served by having Mr. Robeson on Eleanor Roosevelt's program. For all you who believe in free speech and anybody has any respect for it in these state institutions, you need to know these stories. You only find it by reading Fred Jerome. The Einstein file. And he points out there are shelves all over, library shelves stuffed with books about Einstein, but they never tell you that Einstein was a friend of Paul Robeson and the W.E.B. Du Bois, and he opposed lynching in America, that he said racism is a disease, he said. And of course, he wrote the famous essay for the Monthly Review called Why I'm a Socialist, or What is Socialism? Phil would probably know, maybe not. Anyhow, I think we've drawn pretty close to the end of this operation. This is the Taylor Report, and I want to thank Braden and Febby, and even Phil, and we'll see you next week.